particular the creation of man and woman, which is what Parshas Bereishis talks about. You know that many people often raise conflicts and contradictions between what we know about science and what the Chumash says, right? People will say, how can the world be 5,757 years old if we have dinosaurs and if we have other things, carbon dating and various other scientific tests that indicate that the world is much older, millions of years, billions of years, whatever it might be. And, you know, there are many, many terutzim that are given for these so-called contradictions between Torah and science. And books have been written about it. There are at least two books that were written in the past 5 years by Shomer Shabbos physicists that try to reconcile the Torah's account with that of science, just to throw out some terutzim that are often given. First of all, there's a very important medrash that says that Hashem had created worlds before this world that he had then destroyed. This is the lashon of Bayrei Olamos Umachrivan. He had created worlds and then he destroyed them. Now presumably we're not really sure what existed on those worlds. Were there other people? That we don't know necessarily, but clearly it says there were other olamos that were wiped out. Now even if you take the scientific description of things like ice ages and other things, that exactly corresponds to wiping out and destroying pre-existing worlds. Now, even according to our cheshbon, it is only this world, it is only this existence that is 5,757 years old. So if you find remnants that seem to be very, very old, they could very well be from prior olamos. Because prior olamos doesn't mean that Hashem had to make the world somewhere else and destroy it. It could have been here. Here is where it was. And then it was destroyed. And in fact, when it says in the beginning of the Chumash, there was water, right, on the face of the depths, that could be the flooding from the destruction of those previous worlds. That's one mahalach that one can have. Derech Agav, there was a little digression. Let me share with you a thought that Rav Isher Ber Soloveitchik Zatzal once said. Why was it that Hashem created worlds that he then destroyed? Hashem could have gotten it right the first time. Right? Why was that Kadosh Baruch Hu Bayrei Olamos Umachrivan? So he said this thought, actually, a year in which he had lost his brother, his mother, and then his wife. He had lost three close relatives in 1 year. And he says that everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is for us to take a lesson from. That often a person experiences something in life where their world seems to be shattered. Their world seems to be destroyed. It could be a death, it could be some other great disappointments. And then a person has to decide, do I go on and try to rebuild, or do I give up? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, we have to take an example from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, too, created worlds, and he destroyed those worlds, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu went ahead and recreated. And therefore, we look to God as a source of the notion of creating out of destruction. And therefore, Hashem didn't have to go through all of these things, but he went through these things, so we would learn that if your world is nechirah, if your world is destroyed, you have to go on and you have to rebuild. That's the Bayrei Olamos Umachrivan. But be it as it may, that is one answer that even scientifically could be given to the discrepancies between Bereishis and science. Another answer the Lubavitcher Rebbe used to give, and again, I mean, nobody knows which Teretz is right, we have no idea, is that many things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created were by definition created at a state of advanced age. For example, oil. How is oil created? Oil is created by the decaying bodies of animals and plants over thousands of years of pressure. Now presumably when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, he created the world with petroleum reserves. So if you would have had a scientist who was there the first day of creation and would have done the carbon dating, it would have come out that the petroleum is thousands of years old, even though it was just created that second. In other words, many things HaKadosh Baruch Hu created at a state of development that presupposes an age. In other words, somebody, well, Adam HaRishon is created as an adult, right? So what are you going to say? Are you going to test his bones and say, oh, he's 45 or 945 or whatever it is? Things came into their point of full maturity. Or, for example, many insects live off decaying wood. In other words, they eat decaying wood. So the Eibishter must have created decaying wood for insects to live off. But decaying wood presupposes it's an older tree that rots. So Mamela, the Bava Rebbe used to say that aging is bechlal, not a raya as to when something was created, because many things in the world may have been created at the advanced age. That's yet another mahalach. Yeah.
But those who disagree would say, well, those insects weren't there in the beginning, they developed.
No, I understand. We're not proving, see, and our job is not to prove the Torah is right. That's a question ultimately of our emuna. All we're trying to show is that they can't, their arguments don't disprove the Torah. Now, the third argument, which is very controversial, and some Rabbanim accept it and some Rabbanim do not accept it, is that we don't necessarily know what the lengths of the days of Bria were. This is an old contention. Are we mechliyav? In other words, when we say 5757, we clearly mean from the creation of Adam Harishon. From the creation of Adam Harishon on the sixth day of creation until now is 5,757 years. But it doesn't necessarily give you a hemshech of how long were these 6 days of Bria until the Bria of Adam Harishon. Now we know there's a pasuk in Tehillim that says Yomo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Elef Shanim, that a day of God is 1,000 years. It says in Tehillim Ki Elef Shanim De'Einecha Kayom Esmo, and Elef might be Lav Davka, Elef might just be that in Hashem's frame of reference a day could be millions of years. And in particular, people want to say that even if you say that a day has to be 24 hours, that might only be from the fourth day of creation, because the fourth day is when Hashem created the sun and the moon. That the, and that's the demarcation of a day and a night. But the first 3 days, some argue, just do not have to be 24 hours, and therefore all of these things could have been from the first 3 days. That's yet another mahalach.
Yeah. Can I back up to the previous statement? You were talking about measuring things like decaying, and
yes,
you can't actually tell what that is when it happened.
Right.
Is it possible also the implication that things were created in a state of decay?
Something, in other words, that's correct. Certain things realize their purpose, ironically, only if they're in a state of decay. So those things which serve the world in a state of decay were created in a state of decay. That's the idea of the rotting wood for the insects and for other creatures and the like. So Mamela, there are different terutzim that are given. There are different mahalchim that are given. Etc. But it's always dangerous. It is always very dangerous to try to show how the Torah corresponds exactly to a scientific theory. Because what's going to happen if next week the scientific theory gets disproved? So, you know, it's not good to put your eggs in one basket. It's not good to say, oh, the Torah is right because it fits science. That's not going to be very productive in the long run, because what's going to happen when the science gets disproven? Right? So, the emphasis is this. The real teretz is a non-teretz. It's not a teretz at all, but the real teretz is that the Torah is really not interested in teaching us the scientific methodology of creation. The Torah is not interested in telling us how Hashem created the world. The yesod of Bereishis is that there is a bore, that there is a creator, and therefore there is a purpose to existence. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one that brought everything into existence. Whether Hashem did it through the Big Bang or whether Hashem did it in some other way is not something that we have to know necessarily. It's reminiscent of, I remember reading when I was a kid, Sherlock Holmes, the famous detective who has these amazing powers of deduction. So it turned out that in one of his conversations with Dr. Watson, Holmes was not aware of Copernicus's discovery that the earth goes around the sun. He thought the sun goes around the earth. So Watson said, how could such a brilliant man like you not know that the earth goes around the sun? So he says, in my line of work, it really makes no difference. I mean, what difference does it make if the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun? L'mai nafkamina. He says, I spend my time on things that make a difference in the way I live, and this doesn't. So a lot of the theories of what is called cosmology, how was the world created, is something that we pashut don't necessarily have to know. And Chazal actually tell us this in Maseches Chagiga, where they say a person should not investigate too much what was before the world and what will be after the world. Even, in fact, even delving into Mashiach, which is the end process, there's a certain amount of discouraging, that we're not supposed to necessarily be so preoccupied with Olam Haba. We believe in it, but we don't know exactly what form it'll take and what type of reward we're going to get. And one should involve themselves in how to live one's life in this world. And therefore, the Ramban makes the point that the Torah in Parshas Bereishis does not really give us the Seder HaBriah in detail, but it just wants to inform us of that God is the creator, and that creation has a process going from the lower to the higher, which of course shows that Adam is the Tachlis of Bria. By the way, this is what is often called, the fancy word for it is the teleological order of creation, going from the lower to the higher. So we know, of course, that the very last creation in the world was Chava. Chava was created after Adam. But the Maral comes along and says, yeah, but then Hashem had to close up Adam afterwards. So Adam, he says, got the last one. We'll talk about that a little bit. But often there are Mefarshim that do point out, that there is obviously a special chashivas in the role of Chava, because Chava was in fact created even after Adam. Okay. Now, what I wanted to talk about is this, though. If the yesod of, say, of Parshas Bereishis is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not interested in giving us a scientific account of creation, but rather everything in the Torah is to teach us a lesson that applies to our lives, let me just raise a question that many of the Mefarshim have trouble with, and that is, if you look at Bereishis Perek Aleph, the creation of Adam is described in one way, and then when you look in right, 6 days of creation, and Adam is created on the sixth day, etc., and then you look in Bereishis Perek Beis, and there seems to be almost a different story. Right? Did you notice that? There's like a different story in Perek Beis than there is in Perek Aleph. You have a chumash you could follow. Let me just indicate this to you. Perek Aleph of Bereishis gives us the 6 days of creation. And we then come to the sixth day. Hashem creates the animals. Okay? And then, Vayomer Elokim. Remember, the name, but this is also very significant. The name of Hashem that is used in the entire creation account is the name of Elokim. Now, we'll discuss why that is so, but one of the meanings of Elokim is the God who controls nature. So when God creates the laws of nature, the name that is used is Elokim. And in fact, this is so because Elokim and Hateva, Hateva is nature, have the same numerical equivalent. The gematria of Elokim is Hateva. By the way, you might say, well, isn't that different than the normal explanation, right? The normal explanation we give is Yud-Kei Vav-Kei is God's name of Rachamim, of compassion, and Elokim is God's name of justice and punishment. But now we're saying Elokim is connection with nature. But that's not really a contradiction. Because when we say Elokim is din, we don't mean Elokim is punishment. We mean Elokim is when God conceals and withdraws himself to allow the natural processes of the world to take over. That's called din, because God is not openly intervening in a manifestation of his loving kindness in an open way. So the two meanings of Elokim, that it's din and it's teva, are not contradictory, because din is teva, because din is not so much punishment. Din is withdrawal and concealment, and of course the withdrawal and concealment of God is only from our perception. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is certainly behind the scenes, even in Derech HaTeva, but it's not such an obvious way. Okay, so do remember, as the Mefarshim points out, the Ramban points out, that the name of Hashem that is used in the Sheish Shemei Bereishis is always Elokim, because that's the idea of Teva. Okay, but at that point, Hashem says, or Elokim says, Nase Adam, let us make man, or Adam, Bitzalmenu in our image, Kidmusenu in our likeness, and he shall rule over the fish and the birds and the animals. So first of all of us know Rashi's comments. When Hashem says, Na'aseh, let us make, who is Hashem talking to? So Rashi says Hashem is talking to the angels. that it's derech eretz. There's a derech eretz here that a great person should always seek the advice and counsel of those who are lower than them, just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kav Yachol sought the advice and even the permission of the Malachi Hasharis. So in other words, Hashem is of course doing it, but Naseot. Now if you remember, when King Talmai HaMelech hired 70 elders to make a translation of the Torah into Greek, and he put them in separate rooms, and they all came up with the same translation. If you remember, there were certain things that they changed in order that the Goyim shouldn't get the wrong idea. And they did change the translation of this pasuk. They didn't want to put Na'aseh, because the Greeks would understand this to mean there are many gods, so they made it E'aseh, I will make. But of course, our Chumash says Na'aseh, not because Chas V'Shalom there are many gods, because Rashi says the Gadol should be Nimlach B'Katan, the great person should always seek the advice and the counsel of the lower person. By the way, the Hasidic Sforim, it gives a little different twist of Na'aseh, that God is not talking to the angels, but God is talking to the future human being. Na'aseh, you and I make a person together. Meaning to say that unlike an animal, where God creates the animal and the animal is programmed to behave exactly the way it's supposed to behave, instant, human beings are creatures of choice. So the goodness of a human being is not totally a function of God. It's a function of the choices the human being makes. So Nasa, Hashem says to the human being, you and I are partners in your creation. That I give you the body and the soul, and you turn it into something that's good. That's Na'aseh. Okay, but in be it as it may, if you look at the account in Perek Aleph of Bereishis, you see the following salient characteristics. Number one, the name of Hashem that is used is Elohim. Just giving you a list. Number two, there is no mention at all in Perek Aleph of the human being made from the dust of the earth. It just says, Hashem said, let us make man in our image, and it says, Hashem made Adam. No reference to Afar Min HaAdama. That's an omission. It does not mention it. Number three, if you just read Perek Aleph and you didn't read Perek Beis, you would assume that man and women came into existence at the same time. Because what it says is, Zachor Unikeva Bara Osam. Hashem created them, male and female. In other words, it seems to be just like every other animal, where Hashem created the bull and the cow, and Hashem created the ram and the sheep, right? So Hashem created Zachor Unikeva. Again, just reading the pasuk, we'll talk about what Chazal say. Number four, look at the mission that Hashem charged Adam and this woman. Of course, you didn't have a name yet, but this, right? So it says, I have given to you all of this world. And the language was, Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply. Umilu es haaretz, fill the land. Vikivshuha, conquer it. Dominate it. Control it. Kibush is to conquer. By the way, we know that the book of Bereishis does not have a lot of mitzvos. One of the mitzvos that's in the book of Bereishis is the very first mitzvah of the Torah. And that's the mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply, to have children. Many people make a mistake, though, and they think that the source of the mitzvah of Pru Urvu is the verse in Parshas Bereishis, when Hashem tells Adam and Chava to be fruitful and multiply. That is not true. The pasuk in Bereishis is not a mitzvah. The pasuk in Bereishis is a bracha. It is a blessing. The same blessing that Hashem gave to the fish to be fruitful and multiply, Hashem now gives to Adam and Chava. And the mitzvah of Pru Urvu is mentioned in Parshas Noach, after the flood, when Hashem tells Noach and his children, be fruitful and multiply. And I can prove this to you. I mean, we shouldn't say this, but the proof of the pudding is this. In Parshas Bereishis, Hashem says, Pru Urvu, be fruitful and multiply in the plural. So he's talking to man and woman. And yet, paradoxically, the mitzvah of procreation is only on the man. It is not a woman's obligation. Now, at first glance, that sounds very bizarre. What on earth does it possibly mean to tell a man, you have to have children, but your wife doesn't? Well, obviously, a man has to get married and try to have children. However, technically, the obligation is on the man, meaning to say that if a woman would want to remain single, in other words, there's much more of a, again, it's certainly not a desirable thing, but a man halakhically is obligated to get married, to fulfill the mitzvah of pru or vu. A woman is not obligated to get married. Again, this is not at all to say that it's desirable, you know, not to get married, but the mitzvah of procreation is on the man and not on the woman. Now, that has some interesting implications. Why is that so? The Meshech Chachma gives a very interesting explanation. He says, because pregnancy and childbirth is inherently a life-threatening condition. Right? I mean, throughout a lot of history, there have been very high mortality rates for women in childbirth. Today it's a little better, but it still exists. I mean, people can die. So the Torah cannot command a person, you must endanger your life. The Torah can tell a man, find a partner who is willing to do this. And the man should find a partner who is willing to take on the achrayas. But the Torah cannot command the woman who is endangered to put her life on the line. And this is an example of what we say, Durachah Darchei Noam, that the words of the Torah are words of pleasantness, and the Torah would not impose a hardship on a person. The Torah can encourage the man, as it were, to find somebody who's willing, but the Torah cannot impose it on the woman herself. That's one explanation. The other explanation that is given is in the opposite direction almost, and that is that because of maternal instinct and biological clock, it is thought, again these are generalities, it is thought that a woman would want to have children even without the force of a command. A man might figure he has all the time in the world, and he wants to sow his wild oats or whatever it is, therefore the Torah tells the man, you got to settle down. In other words, the concept is the man will be less driven by the instinct, therefore he needs the incentive of the command. But the point I'm making is this. Parshas Bereishis cannot be the mitzvah of pru or vu, because that's directed to Adam and Chava, and Chava does not have the mitzvah of pru or vu. In Parshas Noach, however, there's already more than one man. So there it also says pru or vu, but it could be addressed to Noach u'banav. So that's why the mitzvah of procreation is in Noach. The bracha of fertility and procreation is in Parshas Bereishis. Question?
Yeah, isn't that going backwards? I mean, you're proving that the mitzvah doesn't come from this point by saying...
No, you're correct. You're correct. Yeah. You're correct. I'm not proving from the Chumash that this isn't the mitzvah. No, you're correct. All I'm saying is that based on the halachic understanding of the mitzvah, this is taken to be only the bracha and not the mitzvah. You're correct. The assertion is not proven from this, but rather as a result of the halacha, this is how we interpret these two verses. Was there another question? No. Okay. Yes.
According to this, then the man is commanded, is required, has to. The woman has a choice.
It's very complicated. A woman has a choice, but once a man and woman are in a marriage, the woman really doesn't have a choice in that if the woman, let's say, wants to practice birth control. Again, I'm not going to go into all the shilas here, but let's assume there would be no justification, but the woman just wants to practice birth control. She may have the choice, but the husband would not be allowed to stay in a relationship in which children are ruled out. Unless, of course, there are special heteros that would permit it. Now, so she does have the choice of remaining single, but once there is a marriage, then the husband's obligations come into play in terms of the wife's responsibilities as well.
And she's putting her life in danger, and it's much more of a test.
Yes.
But you said it's not a mitzvah for her.
It's not a mitzvah for her, that's correct. But once she is in a marriage, and one of the parties to the marriage has a mitzvah, then it's part of the marital responsibility to facilitate the husband's performance of his mitzvah. But again, I'm speaking in very, very general terms here. I'm not at all speaking in terms of, in other words, when I'm talking about pregnancy as life-threatening, I'm talking about pregnancy in general. If we have specific, unique risk factors, that's a totally different situation, okay? I mean to say that every pregnancy is viewed as potentially life-threatening, and therefore the Torah did not require a woman outside of a marriage to bedafka seek to have children. But if you're dealing with a woman that has a health problem, that's a, you know, then by and large, of course, there are heterim and requirements to have contraception when that is necessary. Okay. But the mission that's given here, though, is, going back to Bereishis, Perek Aleph, kibush. Kibush is conquest, domination, control. You know that in this day and age, the environmental movements are very, very popular. And you may know that some environmentalists attack what they call the Judeo-Christian ethic, which tells the human being that you are the boss of the world, you can do what you want, you can cut down all the trees and eat all the fish and destroy all the grass for your buildings. And they point to Genesis chapter 1, where the mission that is given to Adam HaRishon is to conquer instead of living in harmony with, and therefore they even blame the environmental problems of the world on the Jews, right? So everything, we get in trouble for everything. Okay, we'll discuss the answer to that in a moment when we look at Perek Beis. But I just wanted to point out four features of Perek Aleph. Name of Hashem Elokim, omission of any reference to being created from the dust of the earth, that is not mentioned. Number three, the apparent simultaneous emergence of man and woman, Zachor Unikeva Bara Osam. And number four, the mission of conquest, control, and domination. Those are four features that emerge from reading Bereishis Perek Aleph. Now, after that, we are told Hashem rested, and Hashem created Hashem rested on Shabbos, and that's why Shabbos became a sanctified day. It became a holy day. Rashi comments, what does the pasuk mean that Hashem finished his work on the seventh day? What does that mean? Hashem finished his work on 6 days. He rested on Shabbos. So what did Hashem do on the seventh day? So Rashi gives two explanations. One explanation that Rashi gives is that we always have to start Shabbos a little bit early because we never know exactly. So Hashem, though, could go all the way to the exact moment. So for us, it already would have been Shabbos. When Hashem stopped creating, for us it would have been Shabbos because it was a minute or two early, but Hashem could go into it. Hashem went up to the limit. The other explanation, Rashi says, is Hashem created one thing on Shabbos. Hashem created Menucha. Hashem created rest. Rest is understood not just in a passive sense, because how can you create rest? If rest means not doing anything, then it's nothing you create. But Rashi describes Menucha as a creation of God, the creation of a capacity to experience serenity and satisfaction with one's work. And therefore that was a bria, that was a creation that Hashem created on Shabbos. Right, so those are the 6 days of creation followed by a Shabbos. Now then, Perek Beis begins, Ela Toldo Shemayim Vars, this is the history of the heaven and the earth, and then it describes again the creation of man. And it repeats it, and it gives a lot of different details. And in the four respects that I mentioned in Perek Aleph are contradicted in Perek Beis. First of all, the name of Hashem that is used in Perek Beis is no longer Elokim, but it is Hashem Elokim. Hashem is Yitzhak Bevke Elokim. So there is a change in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's distinction number one. Again, these will just be the mirror images of the four things. Distinction number two is, here it describes in great detail how HaKadosh Baruch Hu formed the human being from the dust of the earth, from the mud. Remember, the way it's described is there were like underground waters that were keeping the soil moist, and Hashem made us as mud men, mud pies. We were formed in mud. And it mentions that. Number three, Here is where the creation of Chava is described in very different terms, where Adam, all the animals come to Adam, and Adam gives names to all the animals, and Adam sees that all the animals have partners, all the animals have mates, and Adam does not have a mate, and Adam feels very lonely because there is no one to be a helpmate to him. And we have the famous famous pasuk where Hashem makes Adam fall into a deep sleep, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes a part of Adam and fashions Chava out of her, and she is called Chava. Now, by the way, the word Sela, which is often translated as rib, we will see, does not have to mean rib at all. It could just mean side. And we'll see that Chava is not necessarily a separate creation, but in fact Adam and Chava were together and Hashem separated them. I'll get into that. But the fourth point is, the mission that they're given in Gan Eden is very different. If Bereishis Perek Aleph speaks about the message of conquest and domination, the operative words in Perek Beis is Li'avda. I am putting you into the garden to work the garden, to cultivate the garden, to nurture the garden, U'lashamra, and to protect and preserve the garden. Right? This itself would already be our answer to the environmentalists, that if Perek Aleph talks about conquest, domination, and control, Perek Beis talks about preserving and protecting and taking care. You see? You got to read, you know, you always have to read the next pasuk. You can't just like, it's like the person who had a chumash that was interrupted. You know, he's reading the Aseres HaDibros, and lo tirtzach. So one column ended with lo, and the top column began with tirtzach, you should murder. So he started at the beginning of the column, you know, you should murder, you should steal, because the lo was the, you know, you have to, obviously, you have to read the entire context. But the point is the following. What do we make about discrepancies? And this is really a fundamental problem throughout the Chumash, and that is very often things are repeated, but they're not just repeated the same way, they're repeated in a different way. They're repeated in sometimes a contradictory way. So one of the yesodos in explaining the Chumash generally is to how to deal with contradictions and discrepancies. Now, a person who's not a maimon, a secularist, says, well, this just shows that the Torah was written, God forbid, by different people, and there's one version of the story, and there's another version of the story, and the editor was so incompetent that he didn't realize he was inside. I mean, listen, you know, even a good editor wouldn't do that. I mean, let's assume for a second, just for a second, that this is a human composition. But a good editor doesn't keep two contradictory versions of the story. Somebody's going to say, wait a second here, this contradicts what you did in the other chapter. But this is what people say. But obviously a maimon who says that every word of the Torah was dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe. Moshe sat down like a secretary and wrote down every word of the Torah, and the Eibishter gave Moshe Perek Aleph of Bereishis, and the Eibishter gave Moshe Perek Beis of Bereishis, with all the contradictions and all the discrepancies. So there must be some significance in why the Torah writes it in two different ways. Now, some of the discrepancies Chazal give us specific answers to. I'll mention two of them. They do explain why there is a shift from Elohim to Hashem Elohim. Right? Hashem Elohim. That, Rashi himself quotes a medrash that gives us the answer, at least one answer. I'll give you another answer later. And Rashi says the following. Elohim, Rashi assumes, means Hashem's midah of justice and punishment. Midas Adin. So originally, God's original plan was to create the world based totally on Midas Adin. Bereishis bara Elohim. In the beginning, Hashem wanted to create the world as Elohim. Midas Adin. Now what would Midas Adin mean? Midas Adin would mean if you do a mitzvah, so the next day you find $1 million on your doorstep, you do an Aveira, your house gets destroyed with lightning immediately. That's Midas Adin. However, Ra'a, Hashem then saw Sha'ein ha'olam yachol lehiskayim. The world could not exist with strict din, because we're prone to so many aveiros. So the Eibishter combines rachamim and din, And that's Hashem. And that's why originally the creation was Elohim, and then it gets combined with Hashem. Hashem is Yikevokeh, that's the Rachamim, and Elohim. Now it's interesting, the Shelah HaKadosh, the Shelah is an abbreviation, Shnei Luchos HaBris. This is a very, very famous Sefer and a famous Kabbalist who lived in the 1500s. The Shelah writes, this is why it's like, he looks at them through the lens of Din, as opposed to most of us, where Hashem looks at us through the Midah of Rachamim and Din. And the Shelah HaKadosh says, this is the meaning of the Medrash that says when Rabbi Akiva was being tortured by the Romans, and if you remember from Yom, we read it on Yom Kippur, that his skin was being flayed by iron combs, and the Malachi HaShareis are crying to Hashem. And they're saying to Hashem, how could you allow this to happen? Zu Torah, v'zu Sechara. Here is a man who has learned all this Torah, and this is the reward? And Hashem's language was, Shesok, don't question me. Kach ola b'machshav alafana. This is my thought. This is my decision. So most of us just interpret that to Hashem saying, don't ask questions, this is my decision. The Shelah HaKadosh says, no. Kach ola b'machshav alafana means, this was my original plan. He relates it to Gracious. My original plan was that the world should operate on Din. I made concessions to lesser people to allow them to live at a lower standard. But for Rabbi Akiva, I hold him to the higher standard. And at the higher standard, even a Rabbi Akiva cannot survive. I mean, the pure Midas Din of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was so awesome. Right, what do we say in Rosh Hashanah? Mi lo yitzdak lefanecha badin. I'm sorry, mi yitzdak lefanecha badin. Who can possibly justify themselves to Hashem on a midas adin? Even the angels are friends.
How can it be that Hashem didn't foresee what would happen? Why did he have to change the way he planned the world?
Right, right. That's an excellent question. The concept of Hashem changing his mind. The emphasis is that we have to understand that it's not a question of Hashem changing his mind, but it's a way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world embodying his ultimate preference, knowing that he would have to make it different, but wanting to retain that ultimate preference to describe the way he deals with tzaddikim. In other words, he wanted to create the kayach of din in the world, because that is how a tzaddik wants to live. So it's not a change of mind, it's rather Hashem creates his optimal world, and then he modifies it. This is a hard thing to understand, but this is the concept of why tzaddikim rejoice in sufferings. They don't seek it out, because a tzaddik actually likes din, because din is the way Hashem tells the tzaddik what he has to do, what he or she has to do in their lives to correct it. See, most of us, the thing that most human beings hate more than anything is we all hate criticism. I mean, that's very, very unnerving. And yet, the tzaddik welcomes getting a message from Hashem as to what in their life they have to get. There was a story I remember reading, which is not a miraculous story, but to me it's a very, very impressive story. The Sfas Emes, one of the great Gerer Rebbe's, the Sfas Emes, was raised by his grandfather, because his father died very young, the Chidushi Arim. And he used to learn with his grandfather every day. And when he was 8 years old, he once came late for the session, and his grandfather couldn't learn with him. So his grandfather started rebuking him and giving him mussar about learning. You know, you have to learn. How can you waste time and you play, and how will you ever grow into something? Very, very strong words of rebuke. In the meantime, his grandmother, the Chidushi Arim's wife, comes in and says, "What are you yelling at the Einikel? There was an emergency. He couldn't make it. Something happened." So the Chidushi Arim looks at his Einikel, 8 years old, and says, "Why didn't you tell me?" He said, "I wanted to hear your mussar. It was so good for me. I wanted to hear it. I didn't want to wrangle out of it. I wanted to hear what you had to tell me about the importance of Torah." You know, it's a tremendous madrega that a person so much seeks out those ways and avenues in which one can become better. You have to be a very strong person, because most of us, very often, we break under that criticism. But if one is strong inside, one can even hear those elements in which one might be wanting. And one, instead of giving up, one takes them and goes with them. Okay, but... What was I saying before? Okay. So that's Rashi's answer. So Rashi's answer is, first there was Midas HaDin, and then Hashem combines Rachamim and Din, and that's why Hashem Elokim. That's Rashi's answer. There's also an answer for the contradiction of Chava, right? That Perek Aleph says, Zachor u'Nekeva bara osam, they were created together. And Perek Beis says Adam didn't have a companion, and Hashem separated Chava from Adam. So here, Chazal give an answer that Adam was not created as a man. Adam was a bisexual creature. Siamese twins. It's not clear if they were linked from the back or the side, or we don't know exactly how they were linked. But rather, Adam, and that's why Adam is not man. Adam is the bisexual creature that comprises the masculine element and the feminine element. According to this interpretation, it is not that man was created first and then woman was created. There was a man-woman unit, but Adam, this man-woman unit, felt a sense of loneliness because there was no otherness involved, and therefore the creation of Chava was not the creation of something new, but it was the separation of the male and female into two separate components. So it's not a contradiction. Zachor Nekeva Barau Tam refers to the bisexual unit that came into being. And Perek Beis is the separation. According to that interpretation, by the way, Tsela cannot be understood as rib. Tsela is understood as side. As side. Adam and Chava are one. They get torn apart at the side. And of course, there's a very interesting point. That's why the Medrash says that when one gets married, one is literally reunited with their other half. That is where the phrase other half, which is even an English expression, it comes from the concept of du partsufim. Du partsufim means two-faced. Adam and Chava were one. They were separated. They came back together. Came back together again. And this was an idea that was so well understood at the depths of what marriage should be, that even Lahavdil Plato, Plato lived in the time of the Medrash. Plato actually, he doesn't quote it as a Medrash, but Plato quotes this teaching in one of his dialogues, that marriage is the reunification and the attaining of a oneness that was there when there was a separation. That's the idea of a soulmate. So Chazal do give us some tirutzim for this. Well, you know, it's a problem. I mean, the idea of divorce, for example, it is not always going to be the case. It is not always going to be the case that one will marry their ideals either. It's a very, very complicated issue. Everything is bashert in the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decrees what should be with my life, but sometimes part of the gezeira on a person is that they have to go through multiple marriages to learn how to be ready for the real one. You may know that sometimes one can learn things from a failed marriage which can help them very much in a later successful marriage. So there is an element of hachana, there is preparation in life which can prepare a person, but you know, it's not at all clear. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It could also be a spiritual level, because it's, I mean, it's a spiritual level, and it may be only parts of it,
You're saying what, that a soul may be dispersed in several bodies? That's an interesting idea, because you know, it's true that the Zohar always speaks about the Jewish people being comprised of 600,000 souls, because those were the neshamos that left Egypt. You know the famous teaching that there are 600,000 letters in a Sefer Torah, the Zohar says, and there are 600,000 souls who left Mitzrayim. So each neshama has its unique letter in the Sefer Torah, which means each of us has a unique understanding of Torah that we ask Hashem to give us. That's the meaning of the tefillah, the same chalkeinu b'sarasecha,
show us our portion. That's why what you're doing, you're teaching a child, you have to be responsive to the individuality of the child. He has a special letter in the Torah. It's not automatically the same letter. Now, the question people ask is, well, what do you mean 600,000 souls? There are 13 million Jews. So how do you get 600,000 souls? So what you're suggesting might be true, that there might be a fragmentation of neshamos into more than one body, and therefore you now have mixtures. Perhaps we're dealing with mixtures where it's not as clear. They also ask the question that you don't really have 600,000 letters in the Torah. The Torah only has 325,000 letters. That's a pretty big discrepancy. You're off by almost 50%. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky explains that maybe some letters count as more than one. For example, maybe a hey counts as a dalet and a vav. Maybe you're counting it that way. Other people say that in reality the spaces between letters contain hidden letters that have not yet been discovered. And they represent the souls of Jews who are not connected to the Torah yet. And Liyasid Lavo, those hidden letters will be revealed and they will add up to 600,000. And that's why our Sefer Torah is incomplete if there are neshamos in Klal Yisrael that have not become connected. Yeah. Well, you know, even without what I'm describing, when the Torah says Yazov Ish Yisavir V'Yasima, look at the Chumash itself. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they should be one. How does that type of morality allow at all for the possibility of multiple wives, of polygamy, and the like? The only answer I have, it's not a good answer, but it's an answer that some people give. Was necessary for a Yishmael, and they had special things, but if you look in the rest of the Torah, you never find that multiple wives were considered to be a desirable thing. Shlomo HaMelech had 1,000 wives, but that was considered to be an Aveira. But I don't have a good explanation why for polygamy. I mean, we do have reasons why women cannot have two husbands and men can have more wives. I mean, there are reasons given for the discrepancy. But for the ultimate morality, it's very, very difficult to have a good explanation. Yeah.
So, back to the Zivik thing, would you be saying that a first husband would be the true Zivik, or has not met their true Zivik if they had a bad marriage?
You never know. That's the thing. It's impossible to know. There are two possibilities. One is, one could be Makalkel even with their true Zivik. You find the one that was Bashert, you find the one that was decreed. But Hashem does not give you an insurance policy that everything is going to be perfect. It's our achrayus in life to work things out and to struggle and to try to make things good. So sometimes it is the failure of the people involved. That's one possibility. Other times it was just the hachana, preparation for something else. So this is the thing. You never know unless you tried as hard as you could. When you've tried as hard as you could and it didn't work, then you have to assume that it was the Ratzon of Hashem, that this was a preparation for something better. But if you quit before you try, then you never know. This could have been the one. That should have been the one. You know. So there's no simple answer to this.
Let's say someone marries a senior citizen. Like, would that be their choice? I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? Let's say throughout your life you had children, you did what you're supposed to do. It was a horrible
yeah.
life with your husband, you divorced, and then let's say you don't get remarried till you're like 70, would that be...
It might be. It might be that a person's lot in life was to experience his true Zivik for 3 months, mm-hmm. and that was it. And what happens when Rachmanovan, someone dies, very, very young? That could be the Hashgacha too. See, the concept of a true Zivik does not mean, number one, it's going to last for 50 years. And it doesn't mean there'll be no problems in the marriage. It just means this is the one in which your spiritual perfection can be most perfectly realized.
And that may be a very, very difficult and painful process. For example, one could even say that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nisayon for a person is to learn to overcome their selfishness, the zivug might be to be in a very difficult and demanding relationship that requires you to overcome that nida. Okay, so it doesn't mean at all that your zivug will be an easy relationship.
Does that explain the contrast between the zivug and then wherein being the ideal rather than fusion? So that you have to connect all?
I'm going to talk about that, but that's very important. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, in effect, that a relationship does require a recognition of the separateness of the other. That Hashem didn't want the man-woman relationship to be one in the sense that you don't recognize the individuality and the uniqueness and even the differences and the potential tension in the interaction. That on one hand, there has to be a sense that we're one because we were one, but there has to be a sense of the separateness. And we'll talk about that, the age of connection. Yeah. Right. Yes.
And the other thing I wonder is there's some connection between the fact that we were created together then separated, and in the same period we had the separation of the eight and the eight until one was inside of the moment separate, and after the faith they were mixed up inside.
Right.
So it's like it's sort of treating.
Right. It's like trading the connection of man and woman for the connection to the Yetzer Hara. In other words, mm-hmm. The woman gets separated out and the Yetzer Hara comes back in. Well, maybe that indicates the idea that when man is separate, he's more prone to internalizing the Yetzer Hara. They may fit in. But yeah, the concept of first being created as one is designed to teach us that in our relationship to our spouse, husband to wife and wife to husband, we should feel as if we are really really connected. The Gemara says by a husband's obligations that a husband must love his wife like himself, as himself, and cherish her and honor her more than himself. And that comes from the idea of togetherness, meaning the animals, where the male and female were always separate entities. They do their job and then they separate. With man and woman, there has to be a stronger bond. And the other idea, why wasn't Chava created at the same time? The other reason that's given by the Rishonim is that it was necessary for man to feel loneliness and isolation in order to appreciate the blessing of companionship. That Hashem wanted Adam to experience a life, even very small time, a life of being alone. And in that way, he'll be makir tov to Hashem for that gift of companionship.
How come a man would keep his name and Chava changed her name?
Let's think about that. In other words, if we go with the Chazal that say Adam and Chava were created together, so it turns out Adam was the name for both of them. This single thing is called Adam.
But then later,
right. Now then what happened was Chava gets separated from Adam, and at that point she acquires a new name. The new name is Chava. Just look at the pasuk here. Veikach achas mitzalosiv, even Hashem alakim as atzala, she lakach min Adam leisha, he brought her to Adam. Adam said, etzom yatzomayim, v'bazim v'psari, dos ikari isha, yirish lakach azos. Just trying to remember. Who called her Chava? I'm trying to find the pasuk here. Right. Originally, Chava is just called Isha. She is called Isha because she is taken from the Ish, right? So that's just Ish and Isha. At that point, she is not called Chava. Let me just find. After the Chet, then we have the Chet of the Eitz Hadas. And she is called Isha the entire time. The entire time. Just trying to find the pasuk where she's called Chava. Perek Dalet begins Adam Yada Es Chava Ishto, but where was she called Chava? She must have been called Chava before then. 20? Okay.
Vayikra ha'adam shem ishto Chava. He called her Chava because she was Ein Kol Chai. So there are two problems here. It says Adam called her Chava. Yeah, this is Perek Gimel Pasuk Chav. Is there any significance to the timing? Why did Chava not get this name until after the expulsion from Gan Eden? She was called Isha until that point. And she's called Chava, if you assume this is sequentially, she's called Chava only afterwards. It seems to be connected, just in terms of Pshat, it seems to be connected that as a result of the expulsion, Chava was cursed, as Adam was as well, with the pain of childbirth and everything else. And it seems to be that there's a symbolism here that one becomes the mother of life by virtue of the investment and the sacrifice that one contributes. In other words, if childbirth and if rearing children would be an easy thing, a mother could not really be a mother, because the mother is the aim by virtue of the investment. And therefore, it is only after this responsibility of be'etzev tel dibanim, through suffering you will give birth to children, that she can now be called the true mother. Now why Adam rather than Hashem? It could very well be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Adam to now appreciate what his wife is going through. In other words, this was part of Adam's Hakaras HaTov, to recognize her motherhood in the creation of the nurturing of the creation of the children. But that's a very interesting question, that Adam calls her Chava, and this is only after the Chet. Until that point, she is called Isha. Now, again, we won't have time today to go into all the discrepancies. Let me just say a few more others, and then we'll continue next week. So, after Adam is created, and he's together with Chava, that bisexual unit, so what do we have? All the animals are there, and Adam is lonely. And Hashem says the famous verse, Lo Tov, it is not good, Heyos HaAdam Levado, for Adam to be alone. Asa Lo Ezer, let me make him a helpmate, to be Kenegdo, to be opposite him. So the Mefarshim ask a very simple question. Why isn't it good for man to be alone? What's so bad to be alone? After all, this was in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, whatever you want, this is before the Chet. Whatever you want is there. What is so bad? So the Torah gives us a beautiful insight. The Torah says that man, Adam, is created in the image of Hashem, Salam Aleichem. What does it mean to be in the image of Hashem? It certainly doesn't mean physical features. Hashem doesn't have a physical feature. But it means the moral qualities of Hashem, and the Hashem's compassion, Hashem's goodness, Hashem's choice, Hashem's intelligence, Hashem's creativity, although this is infinitely beyond our comprehension. But we have some dimension of that common bond with Hashem that no other animal or creature has. Hashem's dominant characteristic is that of being a giver, because there is nothing that we can give to Hashem, because Hashem has everything. In fact, the Ramchal, the Derech Hashem, based on the Ari, writes, why did Hashem create the world to begin with? Because Hashem wanted to bestow his kindness on other things. If there's nothing in the world, to whom can Hashem give? What is Hashem's need? Does Hashem need anything? The Ramchal says, yes, Hashem needs one thing. He needs something to whom he can give. That is the one need that Hashem has, is to give. In fact, the Ramchal develops the whole theory that ideally Hashem would have liked to create us and just give us reward all the time. Why doesn't he do it? He says, because if we would get reward without earning it, we would be humiliated. We would not feel that good about it. It would be what is called in Aramaic, Nahama de Kisufa, the bread of humiliation. So Hashem creates a world where we have to struggle, where we have to work, where we have nisayon, because when we ultimately earn schar, it is something that we've earned and we feel better about it. So the whole idea is that Hashem is a maker. So the Torah says, Adam in the Garden of Eden has an infinite capacity to take. but to whom can he give? And he can't be godly if he doesn't give. So the Torah translates, Lo tov heyos adam levado, doesn't mean it's not good for man to be alone, but man cannot be good if he is alone. He cannot be a tov. And tov is Hashem. Ain tov el HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He cannot be a godly person if his life is focused on taking and not on giving. And therefore the Torah says, Hashem created the institution of marriage to enable human beings to become godly by learning to give rather than to take. It's an amazing thing. The whole tachlis of marriage, and this is both mitzad the yesh and mitzad the isha, is that we should learn to be givers rather than takers. And in that way, we become spiritually elevated and holy by the process of becoming givers, becoming godly. In Sifrei Chassidus, it says that's the meaning of the next verse that says, Al kein yazev ish es aviv yes imo. A man shall forsake his father and mother and cling unto his wife. So people ask the kasha, Al pi halacha, that's not totally true. A person does not forsake their parents. Kibud aviyem is a mitzvah, even after you're married. So in the Chassidus, they say it's a drush, but they say that when a person gets married, he must forsake the mentality of a child relating to a parent. A child relates to the parent. A child expects the parent to take care of them and give them what they need. So the Torah is saying, when you enter a marriage, do not enter the marriage as a child who enters his parents' house, but rather enter the marriage with the expectation that I am here to transform myself by learning to give to another human being, become elevated, become godly. That is the lo tov peyosa adam levado. They say at a bris, you know, we say at the bris of a child, kishem shenichnas lechupa, ken yikanes latora, I'm sorry, kishem shenichnas lebris, ken yikanes latora lechupa lemasim tovim. As a child entered the bris, so shall he enter the learning of Torah. Chupa is getting married. Masim tovim, good deeds. You know, people ask the question that it's not chronologically accurate, because a bris milah is 8 days. Torah is when a child learns how to talk. You know, you should say words of Torah. Masim tovim is bar mitzvah. Chupa, even under Pirkei Avos, is 18. So it shouldn't say chupa and then masim tovim. It should say masim tovim and then chupa. So what many mefarshim say is this: it all depends on how you translate ma'asim tovim. If ma'asim tovim meant mitzvos, that should be before chuppah. But ma'asim tovim may correlate back to that term lo tov heyosa adam levada, that when the human being is alone, he's in a state of lo tov. He cannot really be a giver. Ma'asim tovim is when every single action you do becomes an act of holiness, because it gives to the other. That's a level only after chuppah. And give a very prosaic example. Let's assume that a person likes a certain breakfast cereal, right? A person likes Rice Krispies or Cheerios. So when you go into the store as a single person and you're deciding, should I buy Rice Krispies or Cheerios? You know, you ask a Rav, what should I buy? Assuming they're both kosher, the Rav will say, you know, I really don't care, whatever you want to buy. Maybe some people may ask the Shiloh, but you know, basically you buy what you want. In other words, that is in the tichum of what we would call a morally neutral decision. There are decisions in life that are morally neutral. Person gets married, the spouse likes Rice Krispies and the other one likes Cheerios. So now you go into a store and you're all of a sudden you have to stop and think, should I get this or that? Or should I get both? An amazing thing has happened. At that point, if you like Cheerios but you buy Rice Krispies, or you buy both, a mundane activity that had no religious significance is now an act of loving kindness. It's an act of chesed. It's an act of godliness. You have raised your madrega by consciously making a decision in order to bring some comfort, some enjoyment, some pleasure, no matter how small it is, to another person. An act of gemilas chesed. That's Masim Tovim. That's Masim Tovim. And everything is that way. You know, it all depends on the mind. You can go through and do all sorts of things all day, and they can be done with a sense of frustration or a sense of resentment. And then, they are indeed just wastes of time and even counterproductive. But if one just like turns on the machshava that I am doing this to be native to another person, for my children, for my husband, for my wife, whatever it is, then the whole maisa gets a different surah. The maisa is a maisa of hatava. It's a maisa of godliness. It's a maisa of kedusha. And a person just as an actual person should actually say this, just like a person says before a mitzvah, hini mi mukhan mazuman, I am prepared to do a mitzvah of tefillin or Shabbos or lulav or sukkah or lighting Shabbos candles. The person can say when they go shopping, a person can say, I am hini mukhan mazuman to do something good for my family, do something good for my children, for my husband, for my wife. And at that point, it becomes a maisa of godliness. And that is what the Torah is saying. Lo tov, it's not good for a man, for a human being, to be levada. Because levada, you don't achieve that. Again, certainly a single person has opportunities for chesed too, so, and one has to pursue that, but the intensity and the constant involvement is much more difficult to attain. Yeah?
I'm sorry.
No, sure.
The same way, I think, the same way that Hashem created us, and that's the issue of Hashem's need for being alone, I still understand why it's wouldn't be enough for a man to have Hashem to have the, that relationship. I don't know why alone for him means him to have a spouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because again,
there are demands of a, uh-huh, on a person in the relationship. It's not like they're getting and getting. I mean, they also have to give. They have to be able to run out of whatever it is that they're doing. There is giving.
That's right, that's right. But the question is that really giving or not? In other words, is there a musag of truly giving something to Hashem? Because what Hashem has given us is infinitely so much greater than whatever we can give back. So the human being is always going to be in a deficit position. The human being never really feels he's giving Hashem something. Because when David HaMelech says, Ki miyadcha nasnu lach, we give back to you what we took from your hands. And therefore, the human being does not have a sense of giving to Hashem unless there's the Azer connector. And it goes back to the fact that one is always in a deficit position. By the way, Rav Huttner points out, just as an aside, this doesn't answer your question, Rav Huttner points out that Hakara Satov is one way that we give back. In other words, Hakara Satov is the way that a receiver becomes a giver in life. That if we, when we receive, give back appreciation and gratitude, in a way we become givers that way as well. And in fact, there is a subtlety in the marriage relation and in all human relations, that sometimes the chesed of giving is to let the other person give to you. The chesed of giving is to be a taker as well. This is more of a problem, I think, for men perhaps than for women, because very often people are reluctant to accept the chesed of another because it affects their vulnerability, it affects their sense of well-being. But sometimes the greatest chesed is to make another person feel important enough that you need them to give you something. So there's a big chesed in taking. It's an art. It's not the taking of selfishness. It's the taking to give somebody a sense that they are important and they are needed and they are necessary. You know, people say that a big chiluk between men and women is whether you stop and ask directions when you're lost. It's already a well-known phenomenon that men very much dislike asking directions. And that goes to the idea that for the male ego and the like to concede any type of imperfection is like an attack on the person. As opposed to women who, b'derech hateva, usually find it easier to form those bonds. By the way, some mafarshim say, this doesn't really fit with the two faces, but some mafarshim say, because Adam's original existence was a levada, and Chava never existed in the world without association. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't fit, that does not fit that medrash. They're different medrashim. That the concept is that Adam's essential identity was defined as a single unit. And Chava's essential identity was always in the context of community. And to this very day, therefore, it reflects the idea that a man will often feel under attack if he has to reach out and ask somebody's help. And a woman feels, again, these are generalizations, but Derech Klal feels less reluctant. But again, as I say, that does not fit the Medrash that Adam and Chava came into the world at the same time. You'll see many ideas. as you learn Midrashim, you know many Midrashim are machloksim and they contradict each other, so you can't say something that is consistent like every single Midrash, but different Midrashim show you different different facets. Yeah.
I was thinking maybe also the distinction is like a Chava with the name Mother of Life.
Yes.
Mother's the natural tendency is to be a giver. It's just your natural innate tendency when you're a mother to give.
Right.
But I don't know if really selfish mothers, it's like
it's an anomaly. It's not a normal thing.
It's not a normal thing. Selfish mother.
Right.
So maybe the act of giving really, that's why we were created, the women we were created to teach them.
We're
the givers, and Hashem created us to show what really giving is about, and that could very well be.
We don't have to necessarily go that far, because we could say that the context of the interaction itself creates the opportunity to give. But you're correct. The Maharal says a similar thought to what you're saying. Let me tell you what the Maharal says. The Maharal points out the fact, this is the famous Gemara that I'm sure you've heard during Sheva Brachas, etc., that man and woman, Ish and Isha, share two common letters, Aleph and Shin. The man has the letter Yud in his name, and the woman has the letter He in her name. Now, Yud and He spell the name of God, Ka. Yud He is one of the names of Hashem. So what does the Gemara say? When there is Hashem in their relationship, very good. You take out Hashem from the relationship, you have Esh. The fire of either passion or dissension will destroy them. Destroy them. That's the Gemara. That's a Gemara in Yevamos. The question the Maharal asks is, why does the man have the letter Yud of Hashem's name and the woman have the letter He of Hashem's name? Why is it that division? So he quotes a Gemara in Menachos that says, Yud represents the letter through which Hashem created the world to come. Olam Haba is created with the letter of Yud, whatever that means. Olam Hazeh is created with the letter He. And that's the meaning, Ki Baka Hashem Tzur Olamim. Hashem created the two Olamas, the Ka, Yud, Olam Haba, He, Olam Hazeh. That's another Gemara. Now the Maharal explains, why is Yud Olam Haba? Yud is a point, a dot. That represents pure ruchnius that's separated from any connection to the earthly world. It's non-spatial. He, the Maharal says, is a composite letter, Dalet and Yud. He calls a He a Dalet and a Yud. So he says, Dalet represents pure materialism. We talk about the four dimensions, length, height, width, and time, or the four directions of the world, north, south, east, and west. So Dalet is Gashmias. Yud is spirituality. So the Maharal says that men, again, generalization, men often find that the world drags them down in their ruchnius, and their kedusha involves a disengagement from this world. We separate. We go into yeshiva, we go into kolo, we go into shul, we go into minyan, because the world drags us down. The world of work and the world of interaction often inspires jealousy and competitiveness and materialism and the like. And the Maharal suggests that one of the things in which the woman is an azer to the man is that the woman teaches the man the capacity of spiritualizing even the material and mundane aspects of the world, to show the human being that in this world there can be kedusha in terms of raising children, in terms of creating an environment, in terms of making a Shabbos. And these are lessons that the man has to learn. These are lessons in which kedusha is not only in the yud, but there's a level of kedusha which involves taking the yud and bringing it into the dalet. And he goes out, and this is why we find that originally Sarai's name was Sarai with a yud. But as Avraham and Sarah grew in their spiritual levels, it is said the yud of Sarai was divided into two hays. She got one hay, and Avraham got another hay. In terms of both of them together, achieved the level of being able to bring the yud into the valley. So the Maharal talks about sanctifying the physical, but others do also talk about the fact that the Ein Kol Chai teaches the man. The capacity of giving. But the Torah says, the point is, you know, that the whole institution of marriage
is to teach us how to be givers and not takers. That is the avoda of marriage, and that is the why the person in a state of singlehood is called a low tov, someone who does not reach the level of tov. I'm sorry, is there a question? Yeah. That's correct, that's correct.
I mean, the only indication that they're even ever going
to
be
parents,
because they're still in the garden, and
yeah.
I don't know that
they're even going to be sexually
being sexual
at birth. Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. Now, the answer to that, though, would be that we find this in the Torah in many, many places. That is, you have to differentiate between the Torah as it's happening and the Torah when it was given to Moshe at Har Sinai. That you do find very... I'll give you another example. When Yaakov wrestles with the angel further on, and the angel smites Yaakov on the thigh, so the Torah says, therefore the children of Israel do not eat the sciatic nerve. You have to understand that that is Hashem talking from the perspective of Mount Sinai, that when Hashem is dictating to Moshe the Torah, and Hashem is describing events that happened 2,000 years before, Hashem, as the author, is saying, and that is why, Moshe, that is why today a husband must leave his parents and cleave unto his wife. So it's not a strict chronological occurrence. Hashem is inserting the notes as he's giving the narrative to Moshe. You find the same thing by Gid HaNasha. Gid HaNasha was commanded to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, but Hashem is connecting it to that particular story. I'm sorry, what time do you have? I have to... Okay, maybe we'll stop here. Okay, Mitzvah Shem... man has the letter Yud in his name, and the woman has the letter Hey in her name. Now Yud and Hey spell the name of God. Ka. Yud Hey is one of the names of Hashem. So what does the Gemara say? When there is Hashem in their relationship, very good. You take out Hashem from the relationship, you have Eish. The fire of either passion or dissension will destroy them. Destroy them. That's the Gemara. That's a Gemara in Yevamos. The question the Maral asks is, why does the man have the letter Yud of Hashem's name and the woman have the letter Hey of Hashem's name? Why is it that division? So he quotes a Gemara in Menachos that says, Yud represents the letter through which Hashem created the world to come. Olam Haba is created with the letter of Yud, whatever that means. Olam Hazeh is created with the letter Hey. And that's the meaning, Ki Baka Hashem Tzur Olamim. Hashem created the two Olamas, Baka, Yud, Olam Haba, Hey, Olam Hazeh. That's another Gemara. Now the Maral explains, why is Yud Olam Haba? Yud is a point, a dot. That represents pure ruchnius that's separated from any connection to the earthly world. It's non-spatial. Hey, the Maral says, is a composite letter. Dalet and Yud. He calls a Hey a Dalet and a Yud. So he says, Dalet represents pure materialism. We talk about the four dimensions, length, height, width, and time, or the four directions of the world, north, south, east, and west. So Dalet is Gashmias. Yud is spirituality. So the Maral says that men, again, generalization, men often find that the world drags them down in their ruchnias, and their kedusha involves a disengagement from this world. We separate. We go into yeshiva, we go into kolo, we go into shul, we go into minyan, because the world drags us down. The world of work and the world of interaction often inspires jealousy and competitiveness and materialism and the like. And the Maral suggests that one of the things in which the woman is an azer to the man is that the woman teaches the man the capacity of spiritualizing even the material and mundane aspects of the world, to show the human being that in this world there can be kedusha in terms of raising children, in terms of creating an environment, in terms of making a Shabbos. And these are lessons that the man has to learn. These are lessons in which kedusha is not only in the yud, but there's a level of kedusha which involves taking the yud and bringing it into the dalet. And he goes out, and this is why we find that originally Sarai's name was Sarai with a Yud, but as Avraham and Sarah grew in their spiritual levels, it is said the Yud of Sarai was divided into two Hays. She got one Hay, and Avraham got another Hay. In terms of both of them together achieved the level of being able to bring the Yud into the Dalet. So the Maral talks about sanctifying the physical, but others do also talk about the fact that the Ein Kol Chai teaches the man the capacity of giving. But the Torah says, the point is, you know, that the whole institution of marriage is to teach us how to be givers and not takers. That is the avoda of marriage, and that is the why the person in a state of singlehood is called a lo tov, someone who does not reach the level of Tov. I'm sorry, is there a question? Yeah. That's correct. That's correct.
I mean, the only indication that they're even ever going to be parents, because they're still in the garden, and yeah. I don't know if they're even going to be sexually
being
with the
birth. Well, yeah. I don't know. Okay. I don't know. Yeah. That's a very good question. Now, the answer to that, though, would be that we find this in the Torah in many, many places. That is, you have to differentiate between the Torah as it's happening and the Torah when it was given to Moshe at Har Sinai. That you do find very... I'll give you another example. When Yaakov wrestles with the angel further on, and the angel smites Yaakov on the thigh, so the Torah says, therefore the children of Israel do not eat the sciatic nerve. You have to understand that that is Hashem talking from the perspective of Mount Sinai, that when Hashem is dictating to Moshe the Torah,
and Hashem is describing events that happened 2,000 years before, Hashem, as the author, is saying, and that is why, Moshe, that is why today a husband must leave his parents and cleave unto his wife. So it's not a strict chronological occurrence. Hashem is inserting the notes as he's giving the narrative to Moshe. You find the same thing by Gid HaNasha. Gid HaNasha was commanded to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, but Hashem is connecting it to that particular story. I'm sorry, what time do you have? I have to... Okay, maybe we'll stop here. Okay, Mitzvah Shem.